You're tuned to WMUA 91.1 FM in Amherst, student and community radio for the Pioneer Valley, broadcasting from our studios, campus of the University of Massachusetts.
Good morning. This is Focus, and our host for today is Ellie Menier-Caddy. Ellie?
Good afternoon. As I've been already introduced, I am one of the co-hosts of, well, many hosts of Focus. And I also am a member of the Amherst Committee on Homelessness. Today our guest is Jay Levy. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks, Ellie. Pleasure to be here.
I met Jay at meetings of the Committee on Homelessness. Jay is a social worker who has worked as an outreach worker and presently is a regional manager for Elliott Homeless Services. He recently authored Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, From Words to Housing. Jay, can you tell us more about yourself and your career, and why did you write the book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways?
Well, I started out back in the 1980s. I've been at this kind of work, working with folks who are homeless for many, many years now. And I lived in the New York City area. So I used to, really right at the doorstep of my home in Brooklyn, New York, I would come across people who were homeless and in need. And at that point, I wasn't, as of yet, hadn't gone through a social work school. Eventually, I went to Columbia University. But among my travels, you know, taking the subways and going wherever I went, people would ask me for money. I would see people out there who were in need, and I was very concerned. I'd carry with me a dollar in spare change every day and give it out. And I always had this quandary or a bit of ambivalence in terms of how much money to give and whether this was really a way of helping someone. You know, you'd see many of the same faces day after day. Back then, there was an issue of long-term homelessness. And it wasn't clear to me whether the money was helping or not. There was people who would be drinking. And I'd say to myself, was this enabling or helping someone? And I decided that it would be really great to get to know these folks and to understand their stories and to find a way to help. And fortunately, I was going to Columbia University, and I went to social work school there and graduated with a degree and decided to go into a career of trying to work with the homeless and to do what I could do to be of assistance. And so over time, I started working with the Manhattan Bowery Corporation. I don't know. There used to be some derogatory tags, you know, like the Bowery Bum back in Manhattan, when people would refer to people who were homeless. And back then, they had the old flop houses and a detox where we would do outreach and try to get people over to the detoxes and to the flop houses. And I was actually doing outreach in places like Penn Station and Port Authority and and over time, I became a bit frustrated because it seemed like there wasn't easy answers in terms of how to help the people that I was meeting. And I was looking for alternatives, you know, better access to housing, better support services were needed once people were housed. You know, how do you work with someone that has major addiction or major mental illness? And the book project pretty much came out of this sense of frustration over the years of wanting to do more and learning kind of as I went what worked and what didn't work. And I started to write down these stories, and I started to write down ways of helping from my own experience, what I saw that was helpful and working. And that ultimately became the book, Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways, From Words to Housing. Now, I must say, from New York, I also traveled on. I went to places like Boston, worked in the shelters there for quite some time. And then I also worked out on the streets and in the woods of Western Massachusetts. And I felt very privileged to do the work and to really hear what people were all about, what they were going through, and to really, after deep consideration, to come up with some pathways toward helping. And so the book is really about their stories and how to help.
I worked briefly as a chaplain, and I always felt blessed when people were willing to share their life story with me. Can you tell us a little bit about what pre-treatment is all about?
Yes. Let me do this. I'll read an excerpt from the book, which I think sets it up well. And the time was the 1980s. Ronald Reagan was leaving office. Homelessness was on the rise. And I was a young social worker, full of ideals, doing outreach at the Port Authority in New York City. And I met this gentleman who called himself Old Man Ray. And the excerpt goes as follows. During my first days of outreach, I was immediately puzzled by the deceptively simple task of helping an elderly homeless man who lived at New York City's Port Authority. He was a short, stocky white male of 67 years with a long white beard. His mobility was somewhat hampered, but he could move slowly by using a cane to get around to the shops throughout the building. He spent most of his time sitting on a milk crate and observing the multitude of people making their way to work and other activities while quietly having a quick nip. You can count on him to be there on a daily basis, along with the variety of shops, newsstands, and commuters. He called himself Old Man Ray, and he had become a fixture at the Port Authority. The first time I approached Old Man Ray, he surprised me with his outward sense of satisfaction and connection to his environment. In fact, while I was still transitioning to my role as an outreach worker, Ray had long been adapted to his life at the Port Authority. During our first meeting, he said to me, "I am the night watchman. If you want to know what goes on around here, all you got to do is ask." He then went on to ask how he could be of service to me. You see, in my mind, he had immediately reversed the tables. My offer to help did not resonate in his world, and I left our meeting feeling a little stuck, yet excited about the challenges of outreach and what appeared to be the enigmatic world of homeless individuals. I was left with an important and at times the central question of outreach. How do you help those who are clearly in need, yet communicate no need for help? Had I taken the liberty to assume too much by thinking that this elderly man who lives on a milk crate at the Port Authority is in need of help? And so when I tell that story, Ellie, I'm really struck. I'm struck by Old Man Ray and his circumstance and the meaning-making that he did in his world, where he became the night watchman, a bit of an information center. And he was really like this elder and presenting to me as a wise elder. And I was the student. See, I came there to help. I thought I was going to be the teacher. I thought I was going to lead the way. But Old Man Ray had, you know, had a few things figured out. And this was his way of dealing with trauma. And if you think about it, the mind is an amazing thing. It's dealing with trauma. It's also connecting to his culture and his way of being in the world as an elder. And he had a lot of dignity. And so the question is, how do we help folks without providing pathways to programs and services where they feel they're leaving their dignity at the door, at the gateway? And I found that to be the real challenge of homeless outreach. And so pre-treatment, what it's about is, instead of assuming that everyone you meet is right away in need of medical services or in need of mental health services or in need of addiction services. I mean, even Old Man Ray was taking a nip. He was a drinker. But that's not what was going to resonate in his work. So the challenge was, how can I meet him where he is at? And that's the cardinal rule of pre-treatment, to meet people where they're at. And it's based on five basic principles of care, and they're universal principles. The first is relationship building. How do we connect with a person, get to know them, maybe in time get to hear their story? The second is common language development and understanding the person's words, ideas, and values. The third is, how do we go about supporting transitions and understanding the process of adaptation? And that same process of how Old Man Ray got adapted to his world living in the Port Authority is also a process he needs to go through in terms of to understand and to consider maybe new ideas, or to adapt to my presence as a person in front of him, or to adapt to program options or housing options, because he's telling me right now he's at home at the Port Authority. And the question is, how can I help transition him to consider other options? And the fourth is promoting safety, because we meet people that sometimes are not safe, are either a danger to themselves or others, or maybe their addiction or their medical issues have gotten so severe that we have to find a way, either through crisis intervention or harm reduction type approaches, how to help a person to hopefully be a little safer where they're living. And the final principle is about the change process, facilitating change and thinking in terms of the stages of change that range from pre-contemplation, when a person doesn't even consider maybe that they have an issue that needs change, to action, when a person is actively acting upon whatever the issues may be to create change. So in a nutshell, that's what pre-treatment is all about. And that's what the book is about. But it talks about pre-treatment through very intricate stories of the people I've met over the years.
I'm wondering, Old Man Ray sounds like he's pretty well adapted to where he's living. Do you meet people that like the way they're living and believe they're doing just fine, and you have other ideas because you're coming from another part of society, and the two clash, and then what do you do?
Well, you're correct about that, and you do meet a lot of people that say they're just fine. And I think, I believe, though, on one level it's a myth to say that people who are homeless are simply choosing it. You could maybe find, you know, someone here or there, especially people who might be part of, a commune or some other way of thinking that's different than the norm. But a lot of folks that are out there, as you get to know them and hear their stories and you get past kind of the guardedness, because you have to realize in the beginning, when you meet someone, they have all sorts of reasons not to trust you or to trust me. And so the process of me getting to know someone, and it's within that process that you get to find doorways toward making offers. But the offers have to resonate in the person's world. So it's one thing when someone doesn't know me, if I say the words, I have a place where maybe you could live or a program that you can go to get help, and they're going to say, well, why would I want that from you? You know, why would I even talk to you about that? And so they'll say they're not interested. But if you get to know someone and you get to understand their world and you understand where they're coming from, and then you frame the offers in a language that they can relate to, and you help, and you know, understand a person's values. So a lot of the folks we meet, and this was true of Old Man Ray too, for instance, value their freedom, their sense of autonomy. That's one of the things that hasn't been taken away from them as a homeless person. Maybe they value their independence or their safety. A lot of folks who are living out on the street, that's one of the reasons they might not trust me when I first connect with them. Not only bad things that maybe has happened to them in the past through others that they've trusted and have felt betrayed by, but also the sense of when you're living outside or you're living even in a shelter, you can feel very threatened by the people around you. It's a lot of people you don't know, and there's a lot of traumatic experiences that go on. So you really have to get past those initial sensibilities. You have to develop a trusting relationship that respects a person's autonomy and talk in a language where you uphold a person's sense of freedom and independence, and then offer a choice of maybe they could do something different. And when you do that over time, suddenly people say, you know what, I'll consider that. And that's what homeless outreach to me is all about. It's about giving people real options to consider toward change. And ultimately, for most of the folks, that means giving people housing options and not waiting for housing over the rainbow, but that housing is something you talk about very upfront. The treatment stuff you tend to get to later, in my opinion. And that's something, as you talk about the housing, you can connect in the possibility of treatment, whether it's for substance abuse, whether it's for mental health, whether it's for medical issues. But the key here is I'm talking about long-term homeless folks, not short-term homeless. When we talk about short-term homeless, keep in mind 80% of the people that are out there, and we're talking anywhere from, 2.3 to 3.5 million people a year across the country are homeless. So 80% of those are the short-term homeless. And for those folks, it would be a different kind of approach, I think. But for the long-term homeless, that's what the book is about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what these approaches are geared for.
I know that when I'm asked to make a phone call to somebody I don't know, it feels kind of threatening almost. What's going to happen? So is that a problem when you're a social worker and you're going to meet somebody you've never met and you're expected to carry on a conversation. How do you get past that that first fear and or questioning?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it can be a very awkward moment, but I tend to think of it as kind of like it's improvisational. You really don't know, you know, who you're going to meet, how they're going to present, what their world is going to be all about. And I find that intriguing, quite frankly, to hear, and it's a gift, you know, to hear people's stories and to hear how they're getting along and what they're doing. And so in that first approach, and when I talk about engagement, this is broken down in the book quite a bit, I talk about the stages of the engagement process. And it goes from a pre-engagement where the first goal is simply to get an initial communication going with someone. Nothing really more than that. I mean, that's the first goal. Will they welcome an initial communication? And there's some ways that we go about it, but to start off, we're looking at things of just, you know, I'm observing the person from a distance and getting a sense, you know, what's safe in terms of coming toward them. Now, this is a mirrored kind of experience because at the same time, that person is probably observing me and thinking, how safe is it to be, you know, near this guy? Some of the things we do is sometimes we do outreach in the general area of a person I want to meet with. And this is a, you know, a technique, but it's also modeling that I'm safe to talk to, because the person will see me talking to other people in their general vicinity, maybe other homeless folks who I already know I'm talking with. And you know, there's a network within the homeless community, so people start to hear, oh, this guy is all right. You know, he's helped me, or he's helped John, or he's helped Joe, and, you know, maybe he could help you. Or sometimes one homeless person will introduce me to another person without a home and say, you know, he needs help too. So there's different ways of bridging yourself toward that initial interaction. When I'm first talking with someone, I'm looking at things like personal space. And am I getting too close? Do I see the person physically backing away from me? So I try to be very careful about how close I come. And I like to come offering a need item when I can. And I think of it as if I was like going to someone's house and I'm a guest. And I'm walking into their world, and I'm walking in not as someone that's going to barge in there and say, I have the answers, and this is what you should be doing, and this is how you should be living your life. I get away from all the shoulds and all of that, and I respect the autonomy, and I really say, I'm a guest. They're letting me into their area, and so I'm bringing something to actually give to them, usually a need item of some sort. It could be, you know, bottled water, or it could be a sandwich, or it could be a gift card to get some food somewhere nearby, or a warm blanket. But I come bearing a gift, and I try to start off the relationship with that. And that kind of gets us through that first awkward moment. Sometimes the person says, get away from me. I want nothing to do with you. I don't want your poison sandwiches, you know, that kind of thing. And you know what? What I do from there is I back off and I give space, but on another day I'll approach again, and I go about it in a very kind of slow way. You know, maybe I'll do more outreach then in the area, or ask if anyone else knows the person and maybe wants to introduce me, things like that. So there's a lot of what I call pre-engagement strategies, and even at that point I'm doing some assessment based on how the person looks in terms of safety, in terms of are there mental health concerns, addiction concerns, medical concerns that might, where the person might need help with. All that assessment starts very early on, and it's sort of a two-level thing. One level is I'm very concerned about the engagement and building trust, and on the other level, I'm certainly doing quite a bit of assessment. And you go from that pre-engagement, once you get a communication going, to ongoing engagement where you're beginning to learn the person's world and listen to their language, the particular words that they use, how they frame things out. And I want to get it to a point where I can start to make offerings. I'm describing to the person what my role is as an outreach worker and the kind of help I can give. And I'm also listening to the person very carefully to hear what they want, what would be useful to them. And then from there, we try to get to the point of jointly making goals. And once we make goals, we really begin our journey. hopefully toward housing or something better for the person.
Sounds like your approach has a lot to do with respect. And from my personal experience, people in authority generally look at the person they're encountering with some kind of, you're not doing this right, there's something wrong with you. It sounds like you avoid that, and that's really very, very appealing to me.
You have to avoid that at all costs. I mean, it just doesn't work the other way around, and unfortunately, it's not my personality anyways. But yeah, the whole approach is trying to understand the person and what works for them. What kind of meaning-making have they made toward understanding their world, you know, what they value? And you want to do things that intersect well with that. And if you think of the homeless, you know, people without homes who are living out there, many of them have just had very negative experiences with authorities, whether it's landlords that they've had bad experiences with, whether it's employers, you know, where they've lost jobs and no longer have the money to make ends meet, whether it's with their own parents, when you meet people maybe that have major mental health issues. So, and then there's just all the trauma that people have been through. You know, you see this also in the shelters. There's a lot of authority and control in the shelters that are run throughout the country and in Massachusetts and even locally. And that's done, you know, from the shelter perspective to keep people safe, but also, you know, people sometimes abuse the authority, people get mistreated, mm-hmm. and people that choose to be outside feel like they've been really taken advantage of by authority. So that's a big issue. And then you have all the different subgroups of people who are homeless, all the different cultures. You have some people who are very sensitive to, let's say, white authority or, you know, white society, if someone maybe is African American, for instance, and so you have to really take an approach that's non-authoritative, and really, like I said, you're upholding a person's sense of freedom, independence, and autonomy, because that tends to be, for people who are long-term homeless, a very strong value.
From all your experience, would you like to take a particular story and tell us how pre-treatment was successful with this individual?
Sure. What I'll do is I'll read another excerpt, and it's from a gentleman that I met in the Boston area. His name was Andrew, or that's the tag I'm using for the book. It's not his real name. And he's an African-American gentleman. He had been homeless for more than 18 years, if you can imagine that. And so I'll read this initial description and talk a little bit more about it from there. The outreach clinician approached Andrew and gave a friendly greeting. Andrew responded with angry affect and said, "You don't understand. I'm no longer playing the game." The social worker replied, "I respect that you want or need some space. I didn't get what you meant by game." Andrew in turn stated, "Look, I've been toyed with before and it's not right. I want you to know, I want everyone to know, that I'm not playing anymore. Listen, yesterday I saw a dollar on the street. You think I picked it up? That's what they want me to do. But I'm no sucker. I'm sitting it out and just watching while others make fools of themselves." The social worker calmly responded, "I think I have a sense of what you're saying. You don't want others to take advantage of you. Who could blame you for that?" Andrew, now more animated, quickly answered, "How could you possibly understand? I had a whole career taken from me. I've been mentally murdered." Andrew paused and then with some discernible laughter stated, "Do you know what it's like to be mentally murdered?" The social worker replied, "You're right. No one could fully understand that unless they go through it themselves. I must admit that I don't know what it means to be mentally murdered. Could you tell me?" Andrew calmly responded while walking away, "I've said enough for now. Besides, I'm in the midst of my own research." And so that was the first conversation that I had with this gentleman, Andrew, who was living in a shelter in Boston, Massachusetts, 18 years homeless, usually hung out in the corner of the shelter so he could see what everybody was doing around him. Even though he was African-American and most of the people at the shelter were African-American, he wouldn't talk with anyone. He had no peers that he connected with at the shelter. He was completely isolated and had a bed in the corner of the shelter. And for months I saw him there, and he would not say a word to me. So this was the first interaction after many tries. I did a lot of that modeling of doing outreach around him so he could see that I was safe and an okay kind of guy. And as you can see in this interaction, you know, he was a bit angry at me through it.
Maybe he was just angry.
Or just angry in general. But he gave me a gift, which was all of these words and this whole sensibility that he had. And he had a certain language that he was sharing with me. He was talking about not playing the game. He was talking about his sense of being mentally murdered. He shared that he was in the midst of some research. Well, these were things that gave me a jump off for our next meeting. And you notice what I tried to do, not all that successfully in that initial interaction, what I tried to do was to cue into his words and say, well, what do you mean by mental murder? Or, you know, when you say you're not playing the game, you know, what does that mean? Or maybe I take a stab at it and try to give my general sense of what that might mean. And then he would reject it or get upset. But I was on this mission in time to understand his words and to understand his values. And how do you think I went about the next meeting with him? What was going to be the jump off to try to connect with him better, maybe a second time or a third time that I approached? And what it was I started with the research, because that was something that wasn't filled with all the rage and the anger. You know, it was something that he was proud of, and it was something that he was kind of letting me know that he's, you know, he's onto something. He's doing something of importance. And I think my sense is that maybe he wanted me to respect that and to see him as a fellow intellectual as opposed to someone who's in need and like the rest of the people at the shelter. He was very clear as I got to know him that he was not like the rest of the people at the shelter. So our next meetings really focused upon the research he was doing, and he was proud to talk about it. And it was all about time travel and his readings of Einstein, and he was actually, you know, a very literate guy. It wasn't clear that he was really doing what I would call research, but it was clear in his world that's what he felt he was doing and what was important to him. And I needed to uphold that. At, you know, in narrative circles, narrative psychology is part of the basis for the book. They talk about looking for that sparkling moment, or they call it working with the exception. And that's you don't work necessarily directly with the problem all the time. You work with the person's story and things that they're proud of and strengths. And for him, at least in the beginning, it seemed to be around the research. I also knew that I might be able to use that research in talking with him as a goal, as a reason to talk about housing. Like maybe you could do better research if you had an office or a place to rest your head, or if you weren't around all these people in the shelter that interrupts your research. So I wanted to go with his meaning, and I wanted to make offerings that could make sense in his world. And over time, I was able to do that with him. And I was able to hear his story, and it was quite a traumatic story and accounting of how he ended up becoming homeless. And he talked about how he had a job working at the T, the Transit Authority. He was someone that worked in one of these booths, and he would give tokens to people for money. And he had a pension, you know, and he had a girlfriend, and he had a place where he lived, and he had a car, and he was very proud of those things. And one day, the place where he was living, it was a big apartment building, caught fire, and he had to move out of the apartment. And then he tried to look for places to live, and he ended up at a YMCA. But the issue at the YMCA was you could only stay there for 2 weeks at a time. It was the YMCA itself was set up to serve people in the military that could stay longer there at a subsidized rate. But you could rent a room there, pay market rate, but you were limited to 2 week stays. And he couldn't understand that. And he was the type of guy, he might have been offered services through the Red Cross. This is a guess by me now. My guess is he didn't want that. You know, he wanted to sort of make it on his own and not get help. And so he ended up going this route of trying to maintain his job and get the housing that he needed through the YMCA. After 2 weeks, he had to move out of there. And then he went to a shelter. And at staying at the shelter, he was working late hours at the T. The shelter had an issue with him coming back at late hours of the night. And I think he had an issue with sharing too much of his personal business with the staff at the shelter so that they would actually give him some leeway and say, okay, you're working, we understand. Well, he got very angry over this, that they said you had to be in earlier, and he felt like his job was at risk. So then he started staying at late-night movie theaters, and he would watch these movies, and they were, in his mind, and he talked about this, you know, dirty movies, which he wasn't interested in the content, but he was there overnight. And he felt that people saw him going to these movies and then started to target him and really didn't want him at the shelter, didn't want him to have a job, and that all of this was somehow taken away from him. Now, as I'm listening to this, and I understand his mental status because I've observed that at the shelter. I've seen him talking to himself. I've seen him in the corner of the shelter, not socializing with anyone. I heard from him part of his story that he would go on job interviews and he would see people with a pen writing things down, and he felt threatened that people were pointing the pen his way. So I was getting the sense that maybe there was some paranoid ideation here that was part of what was going on. That was my assessment piece. But on another level, I was connecting to his story and his values and his needs. And what I said to him is, it sounds like you have been through a tremendous amount of trauma. And anyone, after going through all that, would have a hard time going back to work, finding a place to live, trusting others. And I told him I was very grateful that he talks to me, which at this point he was talking to me quite a bit. And I made an offer to get him benefits. I said, you know, maybe we can apply for Social Security benefits. I think with 18 years of homelessness and everything you've been through, you qualify. Plus, you've paid into the system. You had a job for a number of years, and you say it's been taken away. Well, I think you deserve a benefit. It was important for him to hear that he was deserving and for the benefits to be presented in a respectful way and not so focused on mental illness and disability. He could understand trauma, and he could understand it on the level of he was like someone who had gone through a war. And that's how I introduced the idea of trauma. So I'm doing something here that's called bridging language. And I'm bridging from the notion of his world and what he finds important to this idea of people in war and trauma, and then homelessness being like a trauma, 18 years. And then from there, we started to develop what I call a mental health language. We talk about him being stressed out, and we started to define what is mental murder. And that's what his mental murder was all this stuff was taken away, and he just sort of broke down to the point of not being able to work, not being able to travel on the T because he had too many bad memories associated with his job working at the Transit Authority, feeling that the USA stood for Use Andrew. So he had all of this very rich sense, and also felt very oppressed by white society, and this was all part of it, that they were taking all of this away from him. So I, as a white social worker, really had to present to someone different and really had to be sensitive to his language and introduce the idea of Social Security, and then I would think in terms of houses of language. So one house of language was Andrew's house. Another house of language was the house of Social Security that was focused on disability and can you or can't you work. And Andrew was able to say, you know, I can't work. And I was able to say, well, you're telling me you can't work because you've been mentally murdered. Why don't we talk about how mental murder sounds a lot like what Social Security calls disability? You might not agree with that term. That's just the term they use. Maybe together we can write down your story because it's a powerful story. Let them hear it. And I think with doing some advocacy, we can get you benefits. So that's his story. And we were able to get the benefits, and we were able to get him housed, and by the time he got the benefit, he really believed in me a lot more, had much more trust, and we were able to actually talk about the Department of Mental Health and how they could help with some subsidized housing and support services. He wouldn't go to psychiatry. He was willing to see a therapist. He saw me as a counselor. He said, well, maybe I could get along with another counselor, and that's how I presented it. In other words, a kind of bridging again. And I could introduce you to a counselor at a clinic that can help you. I can introduce you to a case manager that would through Department of Mental Health. And he'd say, well, I'm not crazy. I said, it's not about being crazy. It's about all the trauma you've been through and your inability to trust others. You know, you're very alone in this, Andrew, and I want you to have more support in the world. And that's how our journey unfolded. So eventually he got housed. He had the support service. As far as I know, never got on medications, which maybe he could have benefited from, but he didn't want to go that route. But we were able to work with him and get him housed. He did have, he was at one point hospitalized prior to my work with him. And I wouldn't doubt that he might have gotten hospitalized, you know, sometime down the road after my work with him. But he was housed for several years, last I heard. And so, you know, I think that was a success story.
Yeah, it sounds like you did a great deal of goodness for this man. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back to talk more with Jay Levy.
Yes, you're listening to WMUA 91.1 on the FM dial, the home of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst radio station. And now back to Focus and the discussion with Jay Levy.
Well, it's Ellie again, and I'm talking with Jay Levy today, who is a social worker and has worked extensively with homeless people. There's a new program, I think it's new, in Massachusetts called Housing First. It was started on the Duval Patrick administration. I don't know whether he thought of it or someone else. But how does Housing First differ from other ways of providing housing?
Well, it's a good question. In my book, Homeless Narratives and Pretreatment Pathways from Words to Housing, I have a chapter where I talk about Housing First, and in particular, the REACH program, which is one of the programs I'm an architect of, along with some other individuals. Dave Mazaleski from the Department of Mental Health at the time helped with that process. Andrea Miller, who was a researcher with ServiceNet at the time that we designed the REACH program, which is a Housing First program. And also Jerry Ray, who worked for the Mental Health Associates out in Springfield. He was also someone that helped with doing really the advocacy. You know, I did kind of the vision part of the program and how it could help others within the Western Mass area in particular, and Springfield, where we have most of the housing slots there. They helped with the advocacy to actually get the money and get the grant okayed so we could go forward and build the program. So what Housing First is really all about, and this goes back a few years, it wasn't developed for the first time in Massachusetts. Actually, I'd say places like New York City, Washington, D.C., and some other places is where it first began. And it was this idea of, for a long time, when you think of homelessness, people were over-medicalizing the notion. And they were saying that people, because they had mental health issues, substance abuse issues, even chronic medical issues, and again, I'm talking about the long-term homeless population when I refer to homelessness in the context of Housing First, there was a sense that people who were homeless were more concerned about getting housed and having a place that was safe, where they could be, you know, warm and lay their head, than to get, let's say, psychiatry or to see a medical doctor even. And so Housing First was really a response away from treatment first.
So you're not trying to fix somebody.
You're not trying to fix someone at the outset. Now, it may be that the work, and again, you know, this is reflected in my book, is eventually to help build pathways where a person can, if they choose, access desperately needed treatment services for some pretty serious issues that a person might have. But we don't need to begin with that unless that's what the person wants. So it's all about getting where the person is at, which is the cardinal rule of pre-treatment. And the REACH program that I helped to design is all about that. It's connecting subsidized housing or affordable housing directly to outreach teams and having those folks meet people where they're at, use what I talk about as pre-treatment strategies that we've been talking about through this interview, and very quickly offer housing and say, we'd really like you to be able to be successful in housing. If you want to be housed, let's work on that right away. And be very quick to, once the person has an initial communication with you, to offer things like touring possible housing places where a person can live. And the only catch to the whole thing, as far as the homeless person may be concerned, is the housing does come with a support service. But the support service isn't necessarily treatment. If anything, it's defined as pre-treatment. And it's really about working on the three basic issues that someone needs to be successful at to maintain their housing. Number one, it's about being able to pay rent on a monthly basis. And, of course, affordable housing needs to be the match for that. But that can bring up issues around budgeting, right? If someone has, let's say, a substance abuse issue or just some issue with budgeting in general, maybe it's a skill that they need to build or rebuild, then that's something that the counselor, can work with the person on, because that's impacting their money for the month and their ability to pay rent. So instead of beginning with, you have an addiction, you have to address that. And the person says, no, I don't. And then you say, well, I'm not going to house you till you admit that you have an addiction. And then guess what? The person just stays out there. And we found that instead of, there's a segment of the long-term homeless that instead of bottoming out and then saying, boy, I need treatment, now it's time, now I see what all this drinking and drug use has led to. Instead of bottoming out, you know what happens? They die. And so this really became a moral issue to offer housing first. And like I said, one of the issues was paying rent. The other, to get along in a housing first apartment, was the ability to get along with neighbors, to be able to be a good neighbor and not have constant conflict, or for you to feel threatened by the neighbors or the neighbors to feel threatened by you. And of course, the third thing is to basically take care of your apartment on a level where the property isn't in any way destroyed or somehow damaged, where the landlord might have a concern about that. So housing first really involves relationships with the landlords, finding the affordable housing, offering the housing up front, providing the support services to the people in need, and being able to rapidly respond to crises as they occur. Sometimes it's through the door of crisis that we're able to introduce options that might be treatment options. So a person might go into a medical crisis, or maybe literally it's a housing crisis. Their housing's at risk, and they haven't been paying rent, and it's pretty clear that if they've had an addiction and that's what's going on, at that moment maybe we're able to address it, perhaps offer a detox or something like that. But it's really reversing things. It's starting with the housing and saying to the person, this is kind of an experiment. Let's see how it goes. We'll get you in. And you know what? If the person is using or they have an addiction but they're able to pay their rent, they're able to get along sufficiently with others where it's not a problem that's, threatening their tenancy, they're able to take care of the property, then we don't necessarily worry about the treatment aspects. So it's really when the person is ready, what they want, and how the crisis kind of pushes things to the next level. I think what's also important about housing first, and there's been a lot of research to show this, is that on a physical level, it saves money. It saves a lot of money. So you got the moral issue. People are dying or maybe ending up in jail or getting very hurt living outside. And housing first is a way to remedy that. It's kind of a harm reduction approach. You're getting someone as quickly as you can into safer quarters. Then there's the fiscal issue, and what's been found is that people who are living outside or even in shelters, if they're among the long-term homeless, are often ending up with acute medical concerns, acute mental health concerns, acute addiction concerns. They're going to emergency rooms. They're ending up inpatient more frequently than they need to. And as people are housed and they have a support service, the studies have shown that we can reduce the use of emergency room use. We can reduce the issue around the need for acute services and inpatient stays. And so these are two major reasons for doing housing first, both moral, fiscal, and even quality of life issues for the homeless person themselves and for the community to be able to say that, you know, when you're on the streets and in the parks and wherever you're going, it's not where someone's living, but it's where people can go to play.
I see two problems. One is, how do you know they have money to pay for the rent? And secondly, how do you know housing is available? I understand that housing, affordable housing is really a crisis right now.
Well, it really is, and that's why when I was telling you about the REACH program in Western Mass, what we did is we went after grants, and we were able to get some grants, and that enabled us to have affordable housing that we could offer. And a person could have absolutely no money, and they still can move into the place and pay a zero rent. But our goal is always either to help a person to get back to work or to get them on a benefit or some combination of both. And usually most of the people we meet, if not all of them, at one point or another, prefer to have an income than not to have an income. Some people say there's no way I want benefits, so we work on how we can try to get them some employment. Some people actually collect cans and do things like that to have some income that way. And they'll do it in a very hard-working way. I don't mean like once in a while they collect five cans. I mean, you know, maybe they're earning $20 a day collecting cans.
Working hard,
yeah. And I have a story in the book about Butch, who lived, you know, by the river, and that was his bread and butter. Uh-huh. And he made quite a bit of money doing that.
If somebody wants to buy your book, how can they get a copy?
Well, there's several ways to do that, fortunately. First of all, write in Amherst at Food for Thought Books. They have some copies of Homeless Narratives and Pre-Treatment Pathways from Words to Housing. And also, Amherst Books has a hardcover version. Mm. They have the softcover version, which is a little more affordable, at Food for Thought. Amherst Books has it hardcover. I have a website, jslevy.com. That's jslevy.com, jayslevy.com. And that tells you all the different places that the book is available. You can certainly get it online through Amazon Books, Barnes & Noble, Borders Online. But if you want to support your local bookshops, Broadside Books in North Hampton, in Shelburne Falls, Boswell Books, and like I said, in Amherst Books, and Food for Thought Books.
Well, we're getting close to ending time. Do you have some words you'd like to leave with our audience?
I think just to say that at the heart of this book and the heart of the work I do, it's the basic understanding that positive relationships are really transformative. It can make a real difference with the people that we meet. There's a lot of people out there in need, and what this book is about is not simply working with the homeless, though it happens to be the homeless that we talk about. It's about how you can help any hard-to-reach population. It could be a kid struggling at school. It could be people have whatever their sense or level of need is. The pre-treatment approach is something that I think can work with a number of populations, whether it be the elderly, whether it be anyone that feels alienated and disconnected. It gives guidance on how to work with those.
Jay, thank you for being our guest on Focus today. You're listening to WMUA 91.1 on the FM dial in Amherst, Massachusetts.
I would also like to thank Jay. Thank you so much.
Been great being here, wherever here may be.